This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of us might be dead if it weren't for life-saving surgical techniques. But it wasn't too long ago that surgery was as likely to kill you as save you. Imagine how dangerous surgery could be in the days before antiseptic techniques, when there were no antibiotics to clear up post-operative infections. And consider how painful surgery must have been before the creation of anesthesia. My guest Ira Rutko is a surgeon who has written several books on the history of surgery in the United States. His new book is even more comprehensive. Surgery, an Illustrated History, begins in ancient Mesopotamia and ends in the 20th century. One of the things I was interested in was the phenomenon of barber surgeons. About 1,500 years ago, barbers were fixtures in monasteries where they trimmed the beards of the clerics. In that era, in Europe, clerics, in addition to their religious duties, performed primitive surgery.
By around the 10th century, the Roman Catholic Church made a decision that the clerics should not be involved in health care at all. Prior to that time, the clerics, because they were the most educated people within the continent, were involved in giving health care and, in fact, performed operations. So the only people who were then able to perform surgery were the barber/surgeons. And that is how barber surgeons came about. We're not talking about anesthesia. We're not talking about antisepsis. We're talking about people who really were performing functions which today for you and I would be removing a splinter or perhaps having, if you have a boil, incising it. That was what surgery was back then.
Well, why were the barbers trained in surgery?
It wasn't so much that they were trained in surgery. It was that they were there at the time, sort of like a lucky break. They were the only ones who saw the clerics performing surgery in the prior centuries. So naturally, it grew up with them and their families that they learned how to, and they actually took over the profession of surgery. If it weren't for the barber surgeons, surgery would not exist today as we know it.
Well, how far did barbers progress in the field of surgery?
In different countries at different times, they progressed right along the mainstream of surgery. And in fact, in certain countries, they actually became the surgeons that we would regard today as the modern forerunners of 1994 surgery. It really depends on what particular country you're dealing with. In England, for instance, the barber surgeons were very powerful. And eventually, they assumed control of the Royal College of Surgeons throughout the 16th and 17th, and well into the 18th century. The barber surgeons were very strong. And what happened eventually, in about 1750, the Royal College of Surgeons, which was actually called the Royal College of Barber Surgeons, split. They decided that the barbers were no longer integral to surgery, and the barbers were sort of shunted aside, and a new class of individuals arose, and they were the surgeons.
So was there a time you could go to the barbershop and get a shave, a haircut, and an amputation?
Oh, you ask an interesting question. In a men's barbershop, especially when I was a youngster, there was always a barber pole outside,
mm-hmm.
and it had a red and white thing that used to be circling around, electric motor.
The barber pole.
The barber pole. Well, the barber pole was a throwback to the barber surgeons, and they used to hang a towel outside their shop that was red to represent blood and white to represent cleanliness. And that was how the barber pole started.
What was it like to perform surgery in the days before anesthesia? Anesthesia was first invented in the mid-1800s, but there were plenty of surgical operations performed before that. How complicated were those operations? And maybe you could give us a sense of what it was like to do it without anesthesia.
It was not a very pleasant experience. And one of the most graphic discussions of the entire pre-anesthetic surgical literature involves a mastectomy that was done on a member of the royal family. Actually, she was a noblewoman in England in about 1820, and it's quite graphic. She explains how the surgeon removed her breast with a knife without any anesthesia, how they were screaming and the pain that was involved. It was not a pleasant sight. It's very funny, though, when you look at pictures of surgery prior to 1840, where things are depicted, it's very uncommon to see the patient struggling and screaming. Yet, I can't imagine as an individual in 1994 having somebody amputate my leg or my arm, let alone a breast, and not squirming and screaming and moving around. Yet all the pictures depict very placid patients who are calm. It's something that I've never been able to understand as a historian of surgery.
Do you think they were drugged?
They attempted to drug people. They had opium derivatives and other things. I mean, opium was something which had been around for many years. Obviously, they were not narcotics. They did not have cocaine and morphine and things like that. But there were attempts to give people, let's say, liquor. Alcohol was used, but it wasn't really all that effective. It's hard to imagine that if you're drunk and you're going to have your leg amputated, that you're not going to feel pain.
Maybe they passed out.
Often they did pass out. If you read the descriptions of surgery from the Renaissance on up through around 1850, they talk about having four or five holders, people who would have to hold the patient down. But you must understand, surgery was something that was a last resort. It was not therapy as we think of it today, where if you have, let's say, a gallbladder that's bad, that it has to be removed. You have little choice. If you have appendicitis, it has to be taken care of. Otherwise, you will die from it. Back then, very often, the therapy was worse than the disease. Getting operated on was not a lot of fun.
Well, you point out in your book that in the days before anesthesia, a surgeon was prized if he could work very quickly.
Yes, yes. Well, like we said, if you're going to have your leg amputated and you don't have anesthesia and you are the patient, I think that you want to go to the surgeon who moves the fastest. It behooves you, in fact, to go to the surgeon who moves the fastest. So that very often, the surgeon would walk in, and it was, I mean, common knowledge. The surgeons were very stern figures, and they would wear their coats. Tell you that they used to wear the same coat from one operation to the next. You know how nowadays we wear different gowns and we throw them away or they get re-sterilized or whatever? Back then, they would wear a black coat, almost looks like a tuxedo coat, a formal dress coat, and they would walk into the operating room. They would do the amputation, wipe the bloody knife on their coat so they would remove the blood, put the knife onto the table where it would lay for the next case, whether that was the next day or the next month, and the coat they would hang up and would have all your blood on it. And then a month later, when they would do the next operation, they would put the coat back on, and that's how they went about doing things. But regarding the speed of the operation, it behooved the surgeon to operate fast. They had to. They had no choice. So that a surgeon would very often tell the audience, time me. Watch how fast I can do the amputation. And there are many records that were set. It's amazing how nowadays we think of surgery as something which is very precise and very orderly and something which is done very diligently. Back then, and I'm talking again in the 17th and 18th centuries, they literally would do an amputation in 40 seconds.
Wow.
Yes.
This was before power tools.
we're talking about one entire sweep of a knife down to the bone.
Wow.
I don't want to sound gruesome here, but they would go down to the bone with one sweep around your entire leg or arm, and they would take a saw and cut off the bone, and the amputation was done.
Gee, you know, I'm thinking how really bloody surgery must have been in the 17th and 18th century before there were clamps for blood vessels.
It was very bloody, and clamps were something which really did not come about until the mid to late 19th century. When surgeons such as William Halsted in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins and Theodore Coker in Bern, Switzerland started using them, they would do operations where you literally have pictures of maybe 100 to 150 clamps at a time in the operative field that they would then clamp blood vessels with and have to tie off the to stop the bleeding. What happened prior to that, though, was they used to take a mass ligature. They would take something sort of like a piece of silk, a string, and they would just tie everything all at once. They would include the blood vessel in the arm, the nerve in the arm, the vein in the arm, and just tie everything. And what would happen over the course of time, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, after infection set in, you must realize that infection was something which was considered part of being operated on. It was called laudatory pus. And that laudatory pus was something that they wanted to happen. They wanted you to get infected. Of course, they didn't realize it was getting infected. In retrospect, we realized it was getting infected. They wanted that to occur.
Laudatory is a praise word.
Yes.
Why did they think the appearance of pus was good?
Because they didn't understand that it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is historical perspective. You must understand history. And we're talking again about something which happened 300 years ago. So they thought that it was natural for this exuberant or laudatory pus to happen. We're literally buckets and buckets of pus would fall off of somebody's wound.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Ira Rutko. He's a surgeon and author of the new book, Surgery and Illustrated History. Most of the period that you write about covers the years before doctors knew anything about microbiology before they understood infection and how it could be prevented during surgery.
Yes.
So did most wounds get terribly infected? This was typical?
It was not unusual that the patients died from operations. For instance, let's take the Civil War. The Civil War was one of the major calamities in the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And yet from this major calamity, there was much which came out of good, and meaning particular surgery. There were literally thousands, tens of thousands of amputations that were done on a daily to monthly to yearly basis. I have a picture from a battle, I think it's Antietam, where there's a picture of severed limbs, both arms and legs, literally a pile of 20 of them, and it says, a day in the life of a surgeon in the field. When you got shot in the limb, or if you even broke your extremity, back prior to the time of Lister in 1870 and antisepsis, the common treatment was to do an amputation. It was expected that if you were shot in the, let's say, the upper arm, that you were going to have your arm amputated.
To prevent terrible infection?
To prevent infection from setting in, because that you would get gangrene and you would die. Now, the problem was that in doing the amputation, which again they would do in maybe a minute and it would be done, they would take a hot burning iron and put it to the end of the amputation site to sear the blood vessels to stop the bleeding. Of course, that would cause infection. So as a consequence, and no one really knows the percentages, but the wounds themselves, the amputation sites, ended up being infected. And I would say that you're looking at an infection rate of maybe 75% to 80%. Maybe 1 in 5 people did not have an infection from their operation.
Were a lot of surgical procedures performed under pretty dirty conditions because doctors didn't understand that dirt would lead to infection?
It depends what you mean by dirty conditions. Compared to what we know today, obviously it was very dirty. Compared to what they thought at the time, they thought they were being clean. Their idea of cleanliness was, again, walking into the room, taking the knife, which was bloody from the prior operation, dipping it into water to get off the old blood stain, and then going ahead and doing the operation. Because they just had no knowledge at all in terms of infection, in terms of antisepsis. It was something which didn't occur to them. So if something doesn't occur to you, it's very difficult for you to imagine at that time, in 1850, that it's dirty. Dirty didn't exist to them.
How was it discovered that microorganisms breed infection and that there was a way to prevent infection?
The entire concept of microorganisms and infection was not something that happened overnight. There was a gradual evolution, and this evolutionary process really took many centuries. But it all culminated in around the 1840s and 1850s in Germany and in France by individuals with the name of Pasteur and Claude Bernard and Virchow and other well-known people within the fields of medicine. It was never initially surgeons who found out that organisms were causing infections. That was something that Pasteur and other individuals, Robert Koch, that they did. What happened was that in England, Joseph Lister took up the concept of microorganisms causing infection, and he finally put 1 and 1 together and got 2. And that's how, in the 1870s, we began to realize that antisepsis and cleanliness were the most important things that a surgeon would need to prevent infection.
My guest is Dr. Ira Rutko. He's a surgeon and a historian of surgery. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Ira Rutko, author of the new book Surgery, An Illustrated History. You have an illustration of a cesarean section.
Yes.
That's performed, and I forget what the year is, but it's centuries ago.
It's in the 16th century.
I was really surprised that C-sections were able to be performed that long ago.
Well, C-sections were performed, of course, back to ancient Roman times. There are some people who say the reason they're called cesarean sections is that Julius Caesar was born that way.
Huh.
Now, whether that's apocryphal or not, no one really knows. But C-sections have been around literally for 2,000 years, and they were not done with the sophistication that we have today. And very often the mother died from the actual operation to save the child. But C-sections are not something which are new. They've been around for many times. There are certain operations, and we can go through them. C-section is one, the removal of stones from the bladder, hernias, another operation on the brain called trephination, where they drill a hole through the skull and attempt to remove blood clots, or back then, if people thought that you had a disease within your brain. They would drill a hole through your skull and let the bad vapors evaporate. Those were the most common operations that were done back then. In those operations, hernias, the trephination on the brain, C-sections, and lithotomy, removal of bladder stones, have followed up through the last 2,000 years. And you can see the sophistication of these as they grow.
In earlier days of surgery, were surgeons respected?
Respected, of course, is a relative term, but certainly if we think of surgeons and doctors as they are in America in 1994, the answer is absolutely no. The respect for surgery did not occur, at least in this country, until the 1880s and 1890s. That's really when surgeons came about. It's very interesting if you read some of the literature from the mid to three-quarters way of the 19th century in the United States, there was really not a group of individuals known as surgeons. Back then, everybody was a physician slash surgeon.
Mm-hmm. Well, you write about how in medieval times, a medieval surgeon stood in jeopardy of losing his life if he operated unsuccessfully on a feudal lord. And there was an edict that stipulated that the surgeon whose patient died should be handed over to the family. And the patients, that the family could do what they wished with the surgeon.
Absolutely. And the wise surgeon back then did not operate that often. I mean, he only operated when they knew that they were going to get the patient better. It's not uncommon that there were stories where surgeons were killed operating on somebody because of a death resultant from that operation. And it's not only that the surgeon might have died. If they operate on, let's say, a patient for a cataract or for a problem with the eye, and the operation was not a success, well, what happened was that the surgeon would have his eye removed. And it sounds a little gruesome, but that's what used to go on. And that's really why a branch of surgery called itinerant surgeons came about. Itinerant surgeons were individuals. They were not in the class of barber surgeons. They were another group of surgeons. They would go from town to town. That's why they were called itinerant. They would perform an operation, and it's said that prior to the bad results actually occurring, the itinerant surgeon was gone
right.
from the town so that they couldn't do anything to him.
Huh.
And that's how
before the days of malpractice, it sounds a lot worse.
I'm not sure what's worse, getting hit for malpractice suit of $1 million or losing your arm. They're both very difficult situations.
What was it like the first time you observed an operation?
Well, I will confess that the first time I saw an operation, I fainted. And I was about 15 years old. I had a cousin who was an ear, nose, throat surgeon in New York City. He took me into the operating room. He was going to do a rhinoplasty. Somebody's going to have their nose fixed. And I remember very distinctly to perform that operation, they had to break the bone in the nose to remodel it. And the last thing I remember was the room getting sort of circling around me, and I wasn't able to hear much, and I was on the floor. It was embarrassing as a 15-year-old who wanted to become a surgeon.
Well, how come you stuck with it after having such a bad reaction?
Well, I always enjoyed surgery. I think surgery, there are personality types that go into particular fields in medicine, and surgery tends to look for a definitive answer. I consider myself to be an obsessive-compulsive personality. That's why I write. And surgery provides an immediate answer to a particular situation. It's different than treating somebody with diabetes or emphysema, where the treatment literally goes on for years into decades. Surgery, you have an answer. You go in, you open up a person, you remove the disease, and the patient gets better, hopefully.
Now, what about the first time you performed the operation?
First time I performed the operation, well, it was 1975. I was an intern, and the attending surgeon, this was up in Boston, said to me, well, I think that you're going to do the hernia today. And I looked at this gentleman, and I said, what? And I remember very distinctly, he said, well, you better go read about it, because you've done enough of them that you've assisted now, and I would like you to start. And it's a nerve-wracking experience. The first time you take a scalpel in your hand and realize that you're going to have to cut into another person's body to relieve them of a misery that they have. It is something which you have to learn to do. It is the rare individual that it comes easily to.
Do you have a very steady hand?
I have a steady hand, yes. But it's not something that I would tell you that happened overnight. I've always had steady hands. But I've never seen an individual yet. It's very interesting. Whenever you operate with somebody who's new, or if you have a new nurse in the operating room, whenever they touch an instrument, they start shaking at the beginning. It's very scary to cut on another individual.
I'll bet it is. I don't doubt that at all. Do you ever get over that?
Do you ever get over? I think that surgery is something that you never get over, the mystery of it. I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to take care of another human being and make them better. And I think that you have to approach it that way each day and not lose sight of the fact that you're operating on somebody who is another human being and that you want to get them better. But do I ever lose that? No. I think it's something, and I don't think that a surgeon should lose it. I think you have to be cognizant of what you're doing on a daily basis. If it becomes rote and the person doesn't mean anything as a human being, then you might be in the wrong field.
Have you ever had surgery?
Yes. Yes, I had my appendix out when I was 19 years old.
But you haven't had surgery since becoming a surgeon?
No, I've never had surgery since I became a surgeon. And I would be lying to you to tell you that I would not be scared. I would be scared of getting operated on. I think that it's natural. I think that any person that I see in the office who tells me that they're not concerned and not scared, I think that they're lying to me. I think it's natural to be scared. Surgery is one of the greatest things that we as a race, as human beings, have been able to do, that we can cut into another person, relieve that misery, the mystery that's inside there, make that person better. It's essential to the flowering of all of human existence.
One last question for you. Do you ever play music in the operating room?
No, it's funny that you say that, because I go into operating... When I was in residency, I used to go into operating rooms where surgeons would always have music on. And when I write, when I operate, when I do anything, I have to have silence. Not that I mind talking, but I don't like having music on, and particularly when I operate and when I write. I never have music, and I love classical music, but I don't listen.
But a lot of surgeons do.
Oh, absolutely. I go into operating rooms where other surgeons are on, and there's rock and roll blasting and whatever.
Is that disrespectful, or is that okay?
I don't think it's disrespectful. I think that if it makes the surgeon feel at ease within the milieu of their particular operating room, then I think it's exactly what you want. You want your surgeon to feel most comfortable with what they're doing on your body.
Dr. Rutko, thank you very much. It's been fascinating.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Dr. Ira Rutko is the author of Surgery, An Illustrated History, published by Mosby. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.